This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Men have hunted whales for 1,000 years, for food, for oil, for whalebone. In the new book, Men and Whales, Richard Ellis writes that the history of commercial whaling has been a story of unrelieved greed and insensitivity. Ellis's book tells two stories about the relationship between humans and whales, how we have exploited whales, and how we have held them in awe. Ellis is a marine artist who has traveled around the world to observe whales. His paintings have been shown in museums and galleries around the world. From 1980 to 89, he was a member of the U.S. delegation to the International Whaling Commission. Ellis devotes a chapter of his new book to reconstructing life on a 19th century New England whaling vessel. And when I read the chapter, I thought about the insensitivity of the whaling industry to men. It was a horror to be on board one of these ships. I asked Ellis what kinds of men signed up for these voyages.
Mostly they were farm boys who sought some sort of adventure and life away from the plow. Young men like Ishmael in Moby Dick would find themselves in the Midwest and would come to maritime areas like New Bedford and Nantucket looking for a job. They were very easy to convince that sailing around the world was very exotic and exciting, but unfortunately, once they had put to sea, they discovered that life aboard a whaler was a pretty gruesome existence. They were paid hardly anything. Some of them ended up after 3 or 4 or sometimes 10 years at sea owing the company money. In other words, they had to buy their supplies during the course of the voyage, and instead of making any money, it cost them money to do this. In many cases, of course, it cost them their lives as well.
What I loved is you said if they jumped ship, they'd have to pay for the recapture.
If they jumped ship and got caught again.
Yeah, right, exactly. If they were recaptured, they'd have to pay.
Well, they
for
were
that.
Charged for everything. They were charged for clothes. They were charged for shoes. They were charged for knives. They were charged for almost everything except food. But the food, of course, you couldn't charge anybody. You couldn't pay people to eat food like that. More often than not, it was inedible. It was stored in barrels. There being obviously no refrigeration at that time. It was stored in barrels, and it consisted of salt pork or salt beef. Occasionally, it was salt horse. There were hardtack biscuits, which were approximately of the consistency of a brick, which nonetheless became infested with weevils and bugs of one sort or another. The water was often undrinkable. It, too, spoiled, so that the conditions aboard ship were virtually intolerable. But at the same time, there was no place to go. You were in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. You couldn't very well file a grievance with your shop steward and say, this is not acceptable conditions, I would like to change them. Because remember, you're dealing with the 19th century maritime tradition where the captain's word was law and somebody complaining could easily be flogged.
Say, have we mentioned the rats and roaches?
Not yet.
Yeah.
Not yet.
Plenty of those on board, too,
men,
right?
The crew lived forward in the ship in an area known as the forecastle. It was that sort of triangular area defined by the bow of the ship. The foremast poked down through the forecastle, so what little space they had was often occupied also by the base of the foremast. They slept in little wooden bunks in this. The place had no windows, of course, but and only one hatch that enabled them to get in and out, and that was the only place that provided any kind of air or light. As you might imagine, in a ship that where the product was meat and oil were on deck virtually all the time, the forecastle and the rest of the ship, in fact, quickly was infested by every conceivable kind of vermin, but most infamous were the rats and roaches. The rats were all over everywhere, and quite often the roaches were so numerous that people got to the point where you could actually ignore roaches in your food. And in some instances, they ate them thinking that the protein that they got from eating live roaches was better than the stuff they were being fed.
And this information comes in part from journals that you've read from the period.
Well, occasionally a whaleman, Moby Dick was written, remember, by Herman Melville, who was a whaleman, but that is a unique chapter in the literary history of whaling. But occasionally people who could write, remember, certainly not everybody at that time could write at all, but people who could write occasionally kept journals. This differs, of course, from the log of the captain. The captain was required by law to keep a diary of where he was every day, and whaling captains often recorded the number of whales killed and how many barrels of oil they got. But occasionally a whaleman who was literate would write down his experiences, and it is from those journals that we are able to get a picture of what life aboard a whaler was like in the 19th century.
Well, you've painted a picture of basically hell on earth aboard the whaling ship, but we haven't even begun to describe yet what it was like once a whale was spotted, how difficult it was and how risky it was to actually kill the whale. What was it like during the whaling process in the 19th century?
It was often quite dangerous to the men, but of course we must always keep in mind that it was more dangerous for the whale. There were only infrequent instances where a whale would upset a whale boat. These were rowing boats that were manned by six or seven men who, when the whale was sighted, the boats would be lowered. The men would then row after the whale. Now, we're talking specifically about the sperm whale fishery out of New Bedford and Nantucket and Sag Harbor, Mystic, mostly on the east coast of the United States. They would lower after the whale, and then upon getting close enough to it, they would harpoon it. The harpoon was not the device that actually killed the whale, but it was merely a device for attaching the whale boat to the whale. Then the whale, with a big spear stuck in its side, would panic, and perhaps in a situation like that, in its panic, in its pain, it would thrash about and upset the whale boat. But more often than not, in fact, in most cases, the whale lost this battle. And then the business of cutting in the whale began, which, while it was somewhat dangerous, certainly dirty, and oftentimes monotonous, was not nearly as dangerous as the part of it where you were actually on the open sea attached to a thrashing, dying, very angry whale by a very short line.
Did any of the men actually have to jump on the whale's back to spear it during that death hunt?
In the sperm whale fishery, the men did not actually jump on the whale. It was generally considered too dangerous and basically unnecessary to jump on the whale. After the whale had tired from its run with a harpoon stuck in it, when it had spouted blood, it was already weakened seriously. Often they tried to spear it in the lungs so that it could not breathe, or if they were very accurate, in the heart. Once it had tired, the next step was the lance. They actually stabbed it with a spear from a boat and killed it. And now the whale is dead, and they have to tow something that could weigh 30, 40, 50 tons of dead weight back to the boat, where it would be peeled. The blubber would be peeled off like the skin of an orange. The blubber hoisted aboard, chopped into small pieces, and put into the tryworks, which was a series of cauldrons built onto the deck of a ship, which fires were lit under these cauldrons, and the blubber was melted down. The oil was then put into barrels, and this was the product of the whale fishery.
In Moby Dick, we get a sense of the awe that people aboard the ship had for the whale. Do you get a sense of that when you're reading diaries from the 19th century New England whalers?
I think not. I think that Melville's book is a paean to the whale. It's a celebration of both the whalers and the whaling industry, putting aside for the moment the veneration with which Melville held the white whale and the mystical qualities of the white whale. For most other people, that is, people who were not Melville, whaling was a business. And in this business, one simply had to kill whales. I doubt very much if many whalers felt a particular veneration for their victims. They simply had to kill them. Whale oil was an important part of 19th century American and European commerce. And while I certainly don't apologize for the whalers, I also think that we must see them in their proper historical perspective. They were not, even though I said that it looked as if they were certainly not trying to eliminate whales from the face of the earth. Rather, they were trying to provide a commodity. And the commodity was whale oil. It was used for lighting and lubrication and manufacturing. And since petroleum was only discovered in 1859 in Pennsylvania, prior to that date, whale oil was the primary oil substance used in all these activities.
So you have a certain amount of respect for, if not the whaling industry, the men aboard the whale ships in the 19th century, because they didn't yet have a sense of whales eventually becoming endangered. The men were very victimized by their situation. Is there a turning point where you start thinking that the whaling industry should have known better, was aware of the dangers that are posed to the whale species in general, and persisted anyways?
Well, two things happened to change the concept of whaling from what was referred to in the 19th century as a fishery, even though the whalemen knew perfectly well that their prey was not fish but mammals. What happened is the whole business became mechanized and industrialized. In 1867, a Norwegian by the name of Sven Foyn invented the exploding grenade harpoon. Prior to that, whales had been killed by hand-thrown harpoons. When you could fire a harpoon from a cannon at a whale and also chase faster whales by steam and diesel-powered whale ships, the whole thing changed from a fishery to an industry. And at that point, interestingly enough, regardless of how much we tend to think about the whaling industry as personified by Moby Dick, the high point of whaling was not in the 1840s or 1850s, it was in the 1960s. Tens of thousands of whales were being killed in the Antarctic by Russian, by Norwegian, by Japanese whalers, and it was this that is essentially unforgivable, because by this time, certainly by the 1960s, almost anything that could be gotten from a whale could be gotten from something else. But the fact is that the whaling industry had built itself up to such a juggernaut that it could not even stop itself. And the whaling industry sent ships all over the world slaughtering whales by the tens of thousands. And it's at that point that you begin to realize that this could have, in fact, this should have been stopped.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Ellis. He's a marine artist and has many paintings of whales. He's also become a historian of the whale, and his new book is called Men and Whales. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Richard Ellis is my guest, author of the new book, Men and Whales. What is the state of commercial whaling now? Are there places where it is still allowed?
Commercial whaling is over. On July 23, 1982, the International Whaling Commission passed a moratorium on all commercial whaling. They gave the whaling nations 3 years to phase out their whaling industries, so that by 1985, commercial whaling should have ended. Several countries, including the Japanese, the Norwegians, and the Icelanders, tried desperately to keep their whaling industry alive by various subterfuges. They tried to invent something they called small-type coastal whaling, where they argued that their coastal whaling villages had been in existence for 1,000 years and that this was not a commercial industry but rather a subsistence one. When that failed, they invented something called scientific research whaling, which was a device whereby they could kill whales for scientific research, which in itself is legitimate. But the problem with killing whales for scientific research is after you've killed the whale and done whatever research you're doing, you then have a lot of whale meat left over. And rather than throw it away, these countries sent it to meat markets, usually in Japan, whether they were Norwegians or Icelanders. They sent the meat to Japan, and the Japanese, who like to eat whale meat, continued to do so. So it's possible, and they are doing it even today. So it's possible to see this scientific research whaling as being nothing more than commercial whaling being given another name.
How has the end of commercial whaling affected the whale population?
It has affected it not the way we would like it to have affected it. There are several whale species, right whales, humpbacks, blue whales, that were hunted so extensively that it is possible, we don't know yet, but it is possible that they will not come back to their previous unexploited levels. In only one instance that we know about, and that's the California gray whale, has a population that was hunted to near extinction come back to its previous numbers. And I read this very morning in the newspaper that the gray whale has been taken off the endangered species list. That does not obviously lead automatically to the reintroduction of commercial whaling, but it is true that it is no longer an endangered species because the numbers of gray whales only on the California coast, which is the only place they live, the number has gone back to what we think of as the unexploited population, some 20,000 gray whales. And since this is what we think existed before anybody started killing them, it's very difficult to continue to classify this creature as endangered.
How many times have you been on whaling boats back in the days when there were commercial
whaling boats? I've only been on a whaling voyage once. I went on a Japanese whaler in 1981 because I was... First of all, I was curious to see what was going on, how it was actually conducted. And second of all, because I felt that in order to understand what was going on, I had to be able to get the other side of the story. In other words, I was reading all the propaganda at that time, but since I was writing a lot of the propaganda at that time, it wasn't exactly clear as to what the actual position was. So I went on a Japanese whaling voyage, at their invitation, by the way. One doesn't stow away on a Japanese whaling ship, especially looking like me. I don't look a whole lot like a Japanese. And I went there at their invitation, and I actually watched the whole process. It didn't change my mind. I still thought that what they were doing, and now I still think, that what they were doing was unnecessary and anachronistic. But most importantly, I did get a sense of why they thought what they were doing was important.
What was the experience like for you when you actually saw the whales being killed? I mean, as someone who reveres whales in the way that I think that you do.
Well, I had to steel myself, as it were. I knew that this was going to happen. If I hadn't gone, I would not have seen any whales killed. There were no whales being killed in my living room, after all. But knowing that this was going to happen, I sort of removed myself. It became, in essence, an out-of-body experience. I became an observer for the duration of the voyage so that I was not likely to run down there and grab people and say, stop doing this awful thing, even though this is what I felt. I was their guest. I also, by the way, was in the middle of the North Pacific and was not considered a particularly good idea to start shouting at them saying, stop doing that. They could very easily have chucked me overboard if I had gotten a little too rambunctious. So I recognized what was going to happen, and it did happen. It was not a lovely thing to see. You see a whale shot, you see a whale eviscerated, then you see it cut up into its component parts. I feel very strongly about whales, but I also am I'm a person as opposed to a whale. I think that people have done this thing. I was seeing something, in other words, that had a certain historical relevance, a certain cultural relevance. There are a lot of things that people do that I don't necessarily approve of. Nonetheless, as an observer, as a reporter, I thought it was necessary that I see what was going on.
Can you point to a specific period in recent history where you think people started to have a different relationship with whales and to see whales as this kind of special, wonderful life form that should be protected and so on?
Yeah, there is, actually. You can almost date it. In 1961, John Lilly began to do his research on dolphins and discovered, among other things, that dolphins had a dolphin language. He thought he was going to be able to talk to dolphins and they were going to be able to talk to him. That never happened. But shortly thereafter, the first killer whale was brought into captivity. A killer whale is a large dolphin, not a whale. But the first killer whale named Namu was brought into captivity captured in British Columbia in the town of that name, brought to the Seattle Aquarium, and on that basis, the killer whale became demystified. Then SeaWorld in San Diego introduced Shamu into its oceanarium shows. And at the same time, or shortly thereafter, it was discovered that humpback whales sang. They sing these wonderful, haunting songs. They have very large brains. All whales and dolphins have large brains. So all of these things were coming together in terms of people's consciousness of whales. And at the same time, it was becoming known that there were some people, the Russians and the Japanese were the leaders of the whaling industry by the mid-1960s. By this time, it was becoming known that somebody was killing all of these wonderful, sensible, sentient, intelligent creatures. So the two factors together, on the one hand, whales being killed in large numbers, on the other hand, people beginning to revere whales, beginning in some cases even to worship them, the clash of these two things led to the Save the Whale movement, which ultimately, in 1982, led to the moratorium on commercial whaling.
Do you think if you lived in another century, and if you felt the same fascination with whales then that you do now, that you might have been a hunter?
I don't think I could have felt the same fascination for whales in another century. Whales were seagoing oil wells or seagoing meat factories. Nobody thought of whales as being, except perhaps Melville, but nobody else thought of whales as being in any way special except that they were larger than anything else. But they provided so much that mankind needed that you probably would have been locked up for wandering around saying, don't kill the whales. It would have been like saying, don't kill the chickens or don't kill the pigs, because I happen to have a thing about pigs or chickens. They'd lock you up for that.
Have you ever tasted whale meat?
Yes. I've tasted it several times, as a matter of fact. The first time I tasted it was even before I'd gotten into the whale business, and I was in Norway on a trip, and I found that a restaurant was serving whale meat. I don't know what the species was, but I ordered it purely out of curiosity, and it tasted awful. It tasted like a steak fried in cod liver oil. And I said, I didn't know I was going to be in the whale business then, and I realized it was not something I wanted to eat again. On the other hand, when I was in Japan, and I watched them killing a whale, what they did was they cut a piece about the size of a loaf of bread from the whale that had just been killed, and they served it as raw whale meat. They served it on board the ship as sashimi. And I must tell you that under those circumstances, whale meat actually tastes terrific. It has no fat. They cut it very, very thin. It tasted like filet mignon.
Richard Ellis, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Richard Ellis's new book is called Men and Whales. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.